Blog Talk Radio.
Back and have your time. Oh, fine. Okay, with that, sonic effects. Thanks for particularly Jason and United Kingdom, the Netherlands, my goodness. Portugal, Australia, and even Japan. It's a pleasure to have your company for this episode. Nature's way of Freemasonry. Curious when we look at our order, what we can discover, what we can revisit. Oh, and portion on symbolism today, I think, is particularly curious in that respect, because it reveals some of the intentions around the degrees, the degree work, and the deep psychological penetration of the second degree. It's practical. And just put it out. Where I that it's harsh, not in terms of maintaining that accountability, and that's not harsh. That's clear, but in terms of this sense of failure. A little bit too vague sometimes, I think, where I am in Upper Canada. Vague in terms of what can be done and the exploration of the nature of these challenges that we face. For instance, what's on my mind is about the how we deal with contentious matters. It's difficult because we take so much care. Take so much care not to cause offense. And when offense is more deliberate and open, when conflict is more open, we don't seem quite equipped to deal with it. That, I think, is an affront to not only good taste, but it's always embarrassing when we have grown men, particularly brethren, unable to remember their responsibilities or unwilling, and having found the justification in their own weakness, become emotionally invested in the so-called correctness of what they're doing. And then, you know, the usual mixture of honor and dignity and that whole dogmatic approach to life. What do we do when that happens? Well, there are solutions. And I'd like to think that a lot of us and Grand Lodge officers have concerned themselves and wished that there was a remedy. Well, I don't claim to be the answer to very much, but I think I have an answer to this. Watch what you wish for, because it might come true. We have a good show today. You're going to, I think, really enjoy learning more about Thomas Carlyle. And the music is fascinating. We start with Oliver Nelson and go right through to Dave Brubeck and a magical piece by Benny Carter you're really going to like. Anyway, sit back, get your cup of whatever, and we'll step it up. Thank you. Bill Evans, Paul Chambers, Freddie Hubbard, Eric Dolphin, Roy Haynes, that Oliver Nelson arrangement just crushes it. Whoa. The nature and way of Freemasonry. Every man has his own challenges in life. But what drives a good man? Like the challenges, answers come from the unique history and situation of the commentator. Learning not to accept less than our best, less than the best that Freemasonry has to offer is fraught. Control of emotion, embracing humility, striving for a level of charity in which the recipient never knows the source. It's all so confusing, especially in the clamor of a world in which to feel special is to enter a competitive use of the new old tools of social media. While the crowd surges forward, straining the imagination, discoveries have been ongoing. While the future contains all the potential of Freemasonry, along the way, make some surprising and some discerning discoveries that test our reasoning. Tempted as we are by the quick fix, so many solutions offered, they lead us, as they always have done, into a state of disappointment, always searching, partial. Accumulate knowledge, then add imagination, and you have the formula, knowing they are little without application. They exist, not in a glib comment, but in the inspired behavior of the individual. So when we think of Freemasonry, embrace the authenticity and generousness. The rest doesn't matter. Genuineness and authenticity, the rest, it really doesn't matter. Learn the ritual and ceremony, and protocol and spirit of the occasion. Our responsibility is passage, extending to the next generation the wisdom and dignity of days that go to a time out of mind. The nature and way of Freemasonry. Thank you. Finds the right music at the right time. Wow. A little bit about Thomas Carlyle. We're going to share a Fortuna today. I'll tell you just a little bit about this poet. From Poetry Foundation Online, tells us a bit of the background of this long-lived Victorian author. He was very controversial, great, and variously regarded as a sage and impious, or as I say, impious, a moral leader, a moral desperado, radical, conservative, a Christian. Contradictions were rampant in the works of early biographers. And in the latter 20th century, he was still far from being understood by a generation of critics awakening to his pivotal place in 19th century Britain. But his major works, long out of print and never properly edited, are going to be printed at the University of California Press. So might be worth a look. But by 1985, there were 12 volumes of Duke Edinburgh edition of the collected letters of Thomas and Jane Welsh Carlyle. Carlyle is emerging from neglect and obscurity, from the dubious reputation of early fascists. And that damned him for many in the 1930s and 40s. Or a reactionary windbag and a sham. Instead, he's coming to be seen as innovator and survivor, a man born in the 18th century who lived through most of the 19th and whose early work predated Victoria's accession. Alive, he was an enigma. Dead, he remains a problematic figure for the literary historian as well as the critic. Mighty Carlyle was definitely a Scot. Ecclefechan, his birthplace in rural southwest Scotland, was a farming village remote from the cities, but it was on the path toward the universities of Scotland and the big industrial center of England. And he was the eldest son, and his parents were, as it said, intensely pious. James Carlyle, a stonemason of extraordinary strength of character, and Margaret Atkin Carlyle, quieter but still intense. He inherited their verbal gifts, their intense energy, and their will to succeed, and he left behind their piety and rural values. He went through high school and Edinburgh University with a precocious interest in literature and science and in Scotland. It was during the time when it was going through the difficulties of the Napoleonic Wars. He was a voracious reader, and he flung himself into scientific and mathematical studies, which were an early ambition. And then he tried out the careers. He rejected teaching and the law and the church and freelance translation and reviewing. Long nights reading and writing, a poor diet and stress. He never lost the broad outlines of the hierarchical, duty-dominated Calvinist world picture of his youth. And he found it sat uneasily with the new freedom of university reading and friendships until the 1820s, when he discovered a new heaven and a new earth in German literature, Schiller and Goethe. The results were electric. Clever but essentially sterile mathematical and scientific curiosity was transformed into the agency of a blazing original synthesis of Carlyle's remaining Calvinist belief in his half-understood metaphysic and romantic aspiration. What better to serve you than something that's not clean and precise, but challenging and meaty? Fortuna, that's the poem that I've selected for today. In it, Carlyle describes the fact that no single person can change the world, and that one must not mourn that which is beyond their ability to control. And it begins with the speaker describing how humankind, at least the majority of it, lives in a cycle of rising, toiling, and retiring for the night. And this repeats over and over again as the wind blows and the frost and rain fall. He continues on to describe how there is no reason to be sad if it is a thriftless or indulgent emotion. One cannot alter their state of being by mourning over it. And then in the second half of the poem, he introduces the speaker's own concern. He believes that a life spent thinking and mourning is wasted. He does not have the time for such frivolous pursuits, as he has a goal in mind. The speaker is on a journey, and he is ready for anything he might be confronted with. And his path is his own, and just as one cannot change the trajectory of the world, his own life cannot be altered. It goes like this. Fortuna. The wind blows east, the wind blows west, and the frost falls and the rain. A weary heart went thankful to rest and must rise to toil again, and must rise to toil again. The wind blows east, the wind blows west, and there comes good luck and bad. The thriftiest man is the cheerfulest. 'Tis a thriftless thing to be sad. Sad. 'Tis a thriftless thing to be sad. The wind blows east, the wind blows west. Ye shall know a tree by its fruit. This world, they say, is worse to the best. But a dastard has evil to boot. But a dastard has evil to boot. The wind blows east. The wind blows west. What skills it to mourn or to talk? A journey I have and far I rest. I must bundle my wallets and walk. Walk, I must bundle my wallets and walk. The wind does blow as it lists away. Canst thou change this world to thy mind? The world will wander its own wise way. I also will wander mine, mine. I also will wander mine.
Thank you.
Beautiful work. Lucky Thompson on the horn. At this point in the show, we turn our attention more directly to symbolism, you know, our study of symbolism. None of it matters until it matters. None of it matters until it has meaning. How do you possibly know whether something has meaning unless you take a moment to observe and observing and absorbing information? And then not only that, it's not that somebody's throwing pebbles at a window here. It's, does this apply? Do you apply this to your own life? Or can you? You don't have to. Nobody makes you. Come on. Stand up. You're a man. These ideas are swirling around us. We happen to be alert and intelligent enough to notice that they're there. Do all of them apply? Well, odd question to ask. More important is, how do you sort out your priorities in all of this? Different ideas, different tempos are important given the context. So we need to put a pin in that idea. Lately, we've been looking at Colin Dyer's work on the degrees, what that tells us. What they tell us. And in all candor, the questions that are posed in this material are penetrating. And I must admit, I'm caught surprised that it instills a sense of purpose that has not been the experience in any lodge I've ever attended. Now, I don't know, it's not to cast aspersions here, whether we once did this and now no longer did because of the passage of time and it's a lost piece of education. Or whether it's purposefully done this way for a man to discover on his own. But I would think it would be like saying that would be like having a library with no coherence to it. Just a room full of books in any order. No, we're more organized than that. We are organized. But how we organize, huh? Here, just to illustrate the bookmark that we left, we were talking about W.L. Wilmshurst, that man that I would most like to sit down and have a cup of coffee and talk, listen, argue. He saw significance in the staircase in the second degree. Do you remember? Yeah. And he considered that symbolically, progress in a moral sense must be upward. And so this going up the stairs in the middle chamber and so on the third represented a special moral progress. The number of steps in the staircase for which there is no biblical mandate has been ingeniously used by those who through the years have edited the story of the hieroglyphics of a fellow craft's lodge to bring about some matters of significance in what Dr. Oliver calls moral geometry. Who, unless you're receptive to this, it's like having a fire and brimstone evangelist preaching at you. This is a part that you do for yourself if you can. In a system where almost all initiates automatically go to take the other two craft degrees, the passing system seems to have lost a lot of its original significance. Would you agree? In the two-degree system, which existed to probably the late 1720s, the second step in masonry in England was that of a fellow craft or master, and as the latter might have tended to become the prerogative of masters of lodges, an intermediate degree began to take shape, hived off from that of initiation. For it is clear that the secrets of both these degrees, as they appear later in that century, were given in the first degree in the 1720s. It may be that the 5 points of fellowship, which are extremely ancient use, are so called because they originally were found in the higher of a two-degree system, but retained their name when the degree became a third step and known as the master's degree. In later times, the second step did not have the same significance as a making, nor when everyone took it, the solemnity of the third, which made the candidate equal in rank to the majority of the lodge. But it is a necessary degree and should have a particular meaning in its part in the Masonic progress for all thinking Masons. It represents achievement. It represents and refers to reward for labor, a necessary preparation for the next step. It demonstrates that those who have come thus far through preparation by apprenticeship and greater knowledge by entering the temple may, because of their square conduct, level steps, and upright intentions, meet their fellows with head held high and accept that they're just due without scruple or diffidence, a sense of belonging and a job well done. But W.L. Wilmser summarizes his view of the symbolism of the second degree, and perhaps you'll agree, you'll see some similarities. The work of the second degree is a purely philosophical work involving deep psychological self-analysis, experience of unusual phenomena, and the psychic faculties of the soul begin to unfold themselves in the apprehension of abstract truth, formerly described as mathematics. This work is altogether, now that, wait, that really branches off into that, the work, the exploration of truth undertaken by the Rosicrucians, doesn't it? I'm going to put a bookmark in that. This work is altogether beyond the mental horizon and capacity of the average modern Mason. Though in the mysteries of the antiquity, the mathesis, or mental discipline, was an outstanding feature and produced the intellectual giants of Greek philosophy. Hence, it is that today the degree is found dull, unpicturesque, and unattractive, since psychic experience and intellectual principles cannot be made spectacular and dramatic. So says him. The ritual runs that our ancient brethren of this degree met in the porchway of King Solomon's temple. This is a way of saying that natural philosophy is the porchway to the attainment of divine wisdom. That the study of man leads to knowledge of God. Now that infers a directionality. The study of man leads to knowledge of God, by revealing to man the ultimate divinity at the base of human nature. This study or self-analysis of human nature, Plato called geometry. Earth measuring, the probing, sounding and determining the limits, proportions, and potentialities of our personal organism in its physical and psychical aspects. The ordinary natural consciousness is directed outwards, perceives only outward objects, thinks only of an outward deity, separate and away from us. It can accordingly cognize only shadows, images, and illusions. The science of the mysteries directs that that process must be reversed. So we're not looking from within out, we're looking from out and returning inward. It says, just as you have symbolically shut and closed tile the door of your lodge against all outsiders, so you must shut out all perception of outward images, all desire for external things and material welfare, and turn your consciousness and aspirations wholly inward. For the vital and immortal principle, the kingdom of heaven, is within you. It is not to be found outside you. Within. So we, in this sense, haven't been wrong focusing on the contemplative mind. I like to think that in our, I don't know if it's fair to be this generous, that where I am, we've been in a rush to grow. Just as the growth of masonry in the instance of the early 1700s, masonry had existed well before that. The growth came after a period of tests, the plague, wars, civil war, the great fire in London, tests of faith and belief, you know, that sense that if we are cohesive, then we're predictable and we can predict, and our lives and our communities are more comfortable and safer. Well, that was thrown out the window. That was challenged. The Civil War, a disease. No amount of praying made that stop. The pious weren't saved. Challenges that, challenges our belief structure. And again, I take a great, great leap here. The war that ended all war didn't end all war. The war to end all wars. Partly it was the hubris and arrogance of the so-called peacemakers. Historians, well, history reveals that. It was unacceptable. So inevitably, the hindsight, you know, equips you with this. There was an outbreak. The people that were entrusted to do the right thing didn't know the right thing. And I'm not just talking about the posh that were elevated to positions of military power and really made such tragic mistakes that cost to other men, good men, their lives out of sheer incompetence. We're not talking about that. This is literally a sky that's fallen. Death is raining down on us. As if breathing death wasn't enough in the First World War. It's not a matter of comparing. The insanity is the insanity. As ignoble as we can achieve, the rules didn't work. And when we came out of that period, men were searching. Again, prayer didn't stop a bullet or a bomb. But what did? what did make us feel safe in those conditions was the knowledge that we weren't alone and that somebody else had our back and we had their back. That was the deal. When you come away from that, the world didn't roll out treatment and analysis and understanding of trauma. It didn't. There was this great silence and the usual back slapping. We put a jewel on your breast and metal. And then what? Here, comparatively, the answer to what was left was pathetic. A place, a beer hall where you could go and drink your problems away each night. And most men, stoically, a lot of men, stoically, never spoke. The horrors were that overwhelming. They were being triggered. Today, we call that post-traumatic stress disorder. Isolation, right? What would you turn to? You were there. You were on that battlefield, just like we've been on every battlefield. It was men like you and I, men and now women. Us. What would you look for? You'd look for something that reinforced that sense of protection with dignity. There were questions that weren't asked and still today aren't asked. They're not dignified. But where could you go and what and to give you that sense of belonging? Outside of military rank. Well, military rank is a very select culture. Oh my goodness, if you want to see a muscular argument start, just say something like that. Except when you're sitting down talking to old soldiers, there's a degree of honesty and honor that transcends all the politics and that need to be correct and everything that's gone on. Who has your back? And so we grew. We grew. That's what we wanted to do, and that's what we needed to do. In this little piece of the planet, a million square kilometers, our focus was on growth, making it happen, connecting. We weren't looking at the cost of doing that. We were looking at the cost of not doing it. What choice did we have? So perhaps we did expedite the process of the degrees to hasten that moment of that feeling of belonging. And perhaps we did discount the education and the contemplation that went along with it. But it never negated that. Understanding was the key to Freemasonry. This isn't a competition to do away with that spirit of camaraderie, the esprit de corps. There's nothing that's going to take that away from us. That's a bond that was always there with Freemasonry. But the forge that created this sense within us is deeper than a battlefield. It's making sense out of it all. Character development from within. You close out these other, you push out these other influences, and you focus on the inner man, you. I have thought for about 15 years that bond is an exceptional element in the chemistry of Freemasonry. we can do things because of that bond that we can't do without. So today, where I am, we have that advantage, that moment that we've been waiting for, to rethink. Hindsight is wonderful. But we're at an opportunity, we're at that point where we can rethink what's been happening around us. And the measurement of success, numbers, is just one small part of it. There's also this enriched core beliefs. People that believe and have found great understanding. In spite of the shortcomings and the focus on growth, now we've matured to the point where the quality of the experience is important too. And that's raising some interesting and important questions. The role of religion in our lives is different now than it was when we were boys. Hard that it wouldn't be. It's been a letdown for a lot of people that trusted. But then we're looking at this notion of faith going beyond trust. Well, what we've added is accountability. It's like we have with military and police, religious leaders, all of them are prone to accountability. And that's not going to go away. But we're still vulnerable to dogma, demagogues. The world's only a good place, and the only solution is going to come from me. We get that, we see that a lot. Still. But the world is becoming a closer community and more understanding community, step by step by step, painful step by step. We're learning common language, ways of communicating with one another. That, as you know, is something that all despots fear, because it leads to the exchange of ideas. We deal ideas all the time. And the better ideas prevail, always. Oh, we pay a price for our stupidity. Yeah, there's no question, but the better ideas prevail. Compromise, give and take, that chafing. Rub the two pieces of glass together so we get lens, yeah? So this period of time that we're in holds remarkable potential. All this information coming at us, data without context, has no meaning. It just bits. Create a context, it has meaning. But all of this data needs to be pulled together. And we can rely on our history for that. Whether you're focusing on Grand Lodge or pre-Grand Lodge, the ingredients that led up to Grand Lodge, those formidable ancient lodges that led up to the creation of a Grand Lodge system. There is a need today, just as there always has been. But as we just experienced in the writings of Colin Dyer, some of this is not for the average Mason. Some of this understanding is not. Maybe you and I would want to have a whole group, a whole lodge of people with a capacity for enlightenment. There will be a lot of good men in the room who form their expression of ethics and principles differently than you and I. That notion that we accept or embrace here is the idea of reflection, of contemplation, the inner man. What does the inner man understand that gives meaning and improves the quality of his life? Well, whether we're a capable Mason or not, we can address the questions, the important questions. What is truth? What is justice? What is honor? Is charity a handout? Is that all it is? We leave you here to go about your business for another bunch of days in all its different aspects, so all the listeners within the range of the sonic effects. Life is what you make of it. I think life is good. If you're looking for those perfect days, you have to do exactly that. You have to look for them. They're not going to just pop out at you. Attitude matters a great deal. Hearing yourself complain repeatedly, being around somebody like that is tedious. Usually, it's our tendency to avoid. But being that person, that withering attitude, that misanthrope that just finds no pleasure. Think about what it's like to be hearing yourself like that all the time. Not good. Not good. We're going to move on here. Close the show today. And thank you very much for your attention and your participation. It means a great deal. If you like the show, I don't have a thumbs up and I don't have a Patreon account. Maybe we should think about that at some point. Tell somebody else about it. But demonstrate your convictions by those acts of random Masonic kindness. Include yourself. Be kind to yourself, to your friends, and to strangers. My goodness. The principles of the order are not bound by the doors of a lodge. Far from it. Why so timid? Me? I'm heading off to Canada Day celebrations tomorrow, where I get to join with all my 37 million fellow Canadians and smile and enjoy what we have here. Apart from all the pettiness, petty politics that are going on now, we have some important things to face. Just like a lodge, when things are very difficult, it's no time to turn on each other. This is when we have to demonstrate that we've got your back. We have to stand up. Not be screaming like some children, pounding our little fists on the desk, having a little temper tantrum. Or pointing fingers and just constantly critiquing, like that makes the job. Being around somebody that's constantly complaining always makes the job better, doesn't it? Get out of here. Thanks for joining us. See you again sometime. Thank you.
Thank you.